Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Now, I wanted to bring you a little bit of a literary lunch that gets recorded in bookstores right around Australia. I'm really excited for this one in particular because it's the wonderful Sally Hepworth, New York Times best-selling author, 10 novels, including The Soulmate and The Family Next Door, which has been adapted into a very well-received drama series by the ABC. It is actually consequently gone on to be the fastest growing commissioned drama premiere on ABC of all time. There's humour, there's sass, they are darkly charming. And her new novel, Mad Mabel, no exception at all. Now, please enjoy this literary lunch. It is Sally and the equally brilliant Jessica Detman, author of four novels herself. And Jessica, beginning with asking Sally to play the game Two Truths and a Lie.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Dimmicks Literary Lunch. Today, as you know, we are here to celebrate the best-selling, New York Times best-selling author, the glorious Sally Hepworth, and the possibly even more glorious Mad Mabel. Now, Sally launched my new book a few months ago, and we kicked off with a game that she particularly loves called Two Truths and a Lie. Now, you all seem like pretty bright people. I probably don't have to explain this too much, but in general terms, I will tell you three things about Sally, and afterwards you can put your hands up and vote for which you think is true and which you think is the lie. So, Sally once attended a swingers party for book research, and the inverted commas there are implied. Sally was once a contestant on the game show Family Feud, hosted by Bert Newton, with her twin brothers and her cousin Rosie. And Sally once spent the night with two middle-aged strangers in a two-star motel in Los Angeles while on a book tour. Now have a little think.
Not giving anything away with my face.
Put your hands up if you think that the lie is that she went to a swingers party. Aren't you kind?
Most people.
Who thinks the lie is that she was on Family Feud?
What is it about me that doesn't look Family Feud-y?
And who thinks that it's that she never spent the night with two strangers in a two-star motel? Interesting. We're about evenly split on the last two. And the lie is none of them.
She because means they're all true.
She saves all her lies for her books. So, Sal, in my household, you are known as Sally Books, which is to distinguish you from Sally Biscuits, who makes biscuits, and Sally Josie's mum. In this book, Mabel has clearly already been given a descriptor by her community as a young woman, and it's not to helpfully distinguish her from all the other Mabels in the neighbourhood.
Mabel Biscuits.
But it's because of something or several things that happened in her past. So will you please kick us off with every author's least favourite job? Give us an elevator pitch for Mad Mabel.
I don't know why it is every author's least favourite job, because you'd think we would know that, you know, especially when we're touring our book. But I'll give it a go. So Mad Mabel. Actually, I'm going to start with a story that's a bit of trivia because it's particularly relevant today, and that is that I got the idea for this book right here at this literary lunch 2 years ago. So let me start with that, and then I'll tell you about the what the book's about. So I was promoting Darling Girls, and I did my talk, and as you will find out, I talk a lot about murdering people that I don't like. And then afterwards I was signing books and a woman came up at the end and she was the very last person and she came straight up and she said, Sally, I'm thinking of murdering my neighbour. And I said, fantastic, how are you going to do it? Because I'm always looking for ideas for my books. And she said, I don't know yet, but what I know is that I'm going to get away with it. And I said, how do you know that? And she said, because there's two groups of people that no one ever suspects of murder. And those groups are old ladies and little girls. And I said, thank you very much, that's my next novel. So that was where we started. And then what we have is a book about 81-year-old Elsie, as she is known at the beginning of the book, who lives in a very small lane in Melbourne with there's six little terrace houses. She really keeps to herself, mostly, apart from a war that she's got going with her next-door neighbour, Ishan, over his barking dog. And very early on in the piece, she notices that she hasn't seen Ishan for a while and his dog's barking and there's a pile of vitamins on his doorstep that he hasn't opened. And so she decides to climb the back fence because she's a very agile 81-year-old. And she makes her way into his house and she finds that he has died. Now, he's 93 years old, so it's not a suspicious death, at least it isn't at first, until it is discovered that Elsie is actually Mad Mabel Waller, who is the youngest or was the youngest person ever to be convicted of murder in Australia at the age of 15. And when this comes out, the community all turns against her a second time, and she decides to take matters into her own hands, and she finds a couple of very green YouTubers and she decides to tell her story via YouTube. And so this story is both 15-year-old Mabel's story as well as 81-year-old Mabel as she tries to fight the latest injustice against her.
And it's extraordinary, this book. Now, the character of Mabel is so vibrant and odd and solid and really three-dimensional. And I wanted to believe that if she wasn't, you know, actually based on someone real, that at least she came to you as a fully formed character. Is that what happened?
It is. And that doesn't always happen. That it happened to me once before when I wrote the book The Good Sister, which was about a librarian that was on the spectrum, and she just appeared and I knew who she was and what she thought. And it was the same case with Mabel. And it was, someone said to me recently that was that because of my relationship with my great auntie Gwen? And I thought, oh, maybe it was. I wasn't particularly channeling her. She passed away a couple of years ago. So knowing her, she was up there doing something.
She would have had a hand in it, I think.
She would have. She was a crotchety old lady as well. She's very proud of that.
So besides the person who pre-confessed murder to you in the signing queue here,
we won't reveal her name just in case she's done it.
And also, if you're going to tell anyone that you were planning a murder, Sally would be ideal because she...
Because no one believes me.
No one believes anything she says. She'll gossip about it, but no one would believe it anyway because everything she says is 30% true.
I should add that at the start of it. Well, I usually do add it at the start of every conversation, but I would say at least 30% is true, probably at maximum 35%.
Exactly. So feel free to confess later if you have anything. But what was there any other inspiration, any other jumping off point for this book for you?
Yes. So what I had was little girls and old ladies and murder, which was a great start. But I then had to go away and think about what is this story really about. And I was talking to my editor over in America and we were sort of feeling it out as an idea. And she told me that Anne Perry had just died. Now, Anne Perry was a crime writer and she, when she was 15 years old, she was known as Juliet Hume then, and with her friend Pauline Parker, they murdered Pauline Parker's mother. This happened in the 50s in New Zealand.
And it was made into Peter Jackson's first movie, I think.
I don't know about that, but it was made into a movie.
It was, yeah, and Peter Jackson, who went on to make all the Lord of the Rings films, that was either his first or second movie.
And Kate Winslet starred in it.
Back in the mid-90s, I would say.
Yeah. So what was extraordinary about, I mean, apart from them being so young and murdering someone, was that a lot of the story was about their friendship and there was a lot of interest in the friendship between these two young girls. Some people thought they were lovers. They insisted that they weren't, but they were incredibly close. And it's not confirmed, but a lot of people believe that when they were released from prison, so they went to prison for 5 years, separate prisons, and when they were released, it has been said that they were released under the proviso that they were never allowed to make contact with each other again. And just for your own interest, if you don't know about it, Anne Perry or Juliet Hume started a new life in the UK and started writing crime. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And all of this came out when she was 70, and she found out on the eve of this movie, Heavenly Creatures, coming out, that her story was about to be told. So she died a couple of years ago. So it was of my editors, it was top of mind for her. And we kind of went in there. This is not a retelling of that story, but that was just another little thread about the importance of friendship, the depth of the kind of friendships you have when you're 15. And I have two daughters and a son, and I see a lot of these friendships at play when all you really have is each other. And that got me thinking about friendship. And probably that is one of the biggest themes of this book.
Yes, because this is, as much as it's about Mabel, it's about Mabel's best friend, her bosom friend, to quote Mabel, who is quoting Anne of Green Gables, and that's Daphne, and they meet as small girls and remain close in an intensely special way for the rest of their lives. And there's a really beautiful line early on in the book where Mabel observes of Daphne that, "If my life is a jagged graph of highs and lows, she is the thick, solid line right down the middle." Now, talk to me about that line and how it can apply to, you know, anybody's friendships and anyone's lives. And what do you do if you don't have that line down the middle of your life?
Well, yeah, that's kind of what I was exploring with this book. And I've been really lucky to have had the same group of girlfriends since I was very little, about 7 or 8, and they're still my closest friends. And there's actually another line in the book that says, "The greatest love story of all is platonic female friendship." And I've always thought that, but in the last couple of years, when my marriage broke up, I realised that even more. And especially when you consider the fact that these girls, now women, have been in my life since I was 7, and they're still in my life. They were in before there was a husband. You know, they were in before we had children, and they're going to be around after that. And it just got me thinking that perhaps we can expand our idea of what a soulmate is and expand our idea of the most important people being in your life. Person being in your life is one person and is your romantic partner, because I think for me those girls are my soulmates, and they're so important to me that it got me thinking about what would happen if you didn't have that, and that was something that I kind of wanted to explore in the book.
And if it sounds like we're skirting around things, I would like you to know
that
it's because I can't tell you anything about this book except for the first few pages, because everything's a spoiler. It makes you very difficult to interview, Sally. But this book, as all of Sally's books do, has cliffhanger after cliffhanger after cliffhanger. And one of my favourite moments, which Sally thinks makes me insane, and coming from her, that's quite something. Very early on, there's a moment, and it is a death. There are several deaths in this book, just so you know. And it completely took my breath away. And then it made me laugh out loud, which is why she thinks I'm odd. It's supposed to be sad. And it is. It's very sad. But it is also so dramatic and shocking that you kind of have to laugh. That's not the only funny part in the book. There are lots and lots. And you balance darkness and humour in such a special way. Is that easy for you? And do your editors ever have to tone down your sense of humour?
I'm just looking at my editor. He's shaking his head. No. I think that you can't help but bring yourself to the page. And humour has always been something that's so important to me. I've got that gift from my family. And there's nothing funnier than laughing at your own misfortune.
Yes, you do write incredible fractured and damaged families. And it does sound to me from all I've talked with you about your family that apart from the time you pulled a knife on your dad...
Oh, that's a good story.
You have a pretty... together family. I don't
we're
know.
We're very happy. We get along very well.
And so what?
The knife missed. Can I just tell that story? Because now I sound like a psycho.
Please tell that story for anyone who hasn't heard it.
I don't know if this is going to make me sound like less of a psycho or more, but I want to preface this by saying I was very pregnant. I had my baby just a few days after this incident, and I was staying at the family beach house, and we had three generations in this house, lots of little babies, lots of people passing in the corridors going, shh, to each other. So the tensions were already quite high. And it was Christmas Day. And every time there was food delivered, one of my children would cry and I would get up and I would come back and the food was gone. So all the women in there are nodding. They might have thrown knives too. So eventually I came back, my child was asleep, and there was a tub of ice cream on the table and some of those cones. You know the cones that are flat on the bottom so they can stand up? So I scooped the remaining ice cream, there was just a bit left, into the cone. And I was looking forward to it in a way that isn't right. You know that hunger of a pregnant woman. And there was no more. And I turned around to put the tub in the bin. And when I came back around, my dad was eating my ice cream. And I've never been so overcome. I didn't even think about it. I reached into the knife block. I picked up the knife and I threw it. And it hit the wall behind him and quivered. And he handed the ice cream over wordlessly. And we haven't had that problem again. But I do think that if the knife had, or if I'd been a better shot and I had had a female judge, I think I would have got off.
I think you absolutely would have got off.
If you are just joining me, you're on ABC Nightlife across the nation. My name's Nick Healy. On this New Year's Eve, taking a bit of time to hear a literary lunch Q&A with the incredible author Sally Hepworth. Her latest book is Mad Mabel. She's in conversation here with fellow author Jessica Detman, who's asking Sally about her writing process.
Now, there's a strong theme in this book about judgment of people and not knowing the whole story about who a person is. Elsie/Mabel, who narrates both the present day and the earlier sections of the book, is being interviewed by a pair of true crime podcasters. Did you know the whole story before you wrote the book? Is that how your process works?
I find it so hard to talk about process after 10 books because I have written 10 books 10 different ways. And I don't know, that might be because I'm a Gemini. I get bored of things and I think, oh, maybe I'll try writing it backwards this time. But I usually have got a general sense of where the book is going to go. I don't generally know the ending, but I kind of know a few of the turning points. No, so I didn't, and then I tweak it as I go. So I knew that I was going to tell a modern-day story and also a 1950s story. I was really excited about jumping back into the 1950s. And I knew that Mabel was going to be misunderstood. One thing that's really interesting to me as an author and as a reader and as a human being is the way perspectives shape narrative, you know, and there's always, you know, the three sides of the truth, your version, my version, and the truth. And so I love to play with, because we're all guilty of it. We only know a certain amount about anyone. And in fact, if we knew the whole truth about even people who've done terrible things, we'd probably find something sympathetic about them. You know, maybe they killed someone, but they are a wonderful father. Or, you know, or maybe there was...
Maybe they were heavily pregnant.
Maybe really hungry.
Maybe it was an accident.
And heavily pregnant. So exploring that, I always want to know the why as a writer. So a lot of my page time goes to why. And so really, while I knew a few turning points along the way, I was sort of the story was being revealed to me at the same time as I wrote it.
So, as you said, part of it's set in the 1950s when Mabel is young. And is that your first foray into historical
fiction? It's actually the
second.
My first book, The Secrets of Midwives, has got a thread in the 1950s. A midwife story is told alongside the modern-day midwife stories in the 1950s. So it's sort of like I'm full circle around
on book 10. To that. And did you enjoy the research process? What was the research process?
Well, what was really special is that my mum lived through the 50s and in the particular area where the book was set. And she's also one of 8 siblings. So I had plenty of people to ask. My uncle had written a short book of stories of things that had happened during their childhood, and I got to not plagiarise,
but
I got to be inspired by some of those, and some of those stories actually did make it onto the page, like the one where they lived in a cul-de-sac and they used to have a backyard challenge, which was where they would try and get all the way over the backyards and the back fences in the cul-de-sac, and the first one to make it without being seen by the parents in the house got a prize. That was a real story that my mum's family told. And the ability to pick up the phone and call mum or just meet up with her was so special, because mum has Parkinson's disease and she is limited in physically, but she's not. She's got a lot of, mentally she's still there. And for the book, that was really wonderful research, but it was also, I felt like I got some stories out of her that were really special that I'll get to keep as well.
And stories that you might not otherwise have had reason to ask about.
Yes, and then I got to the point where I could just ring her and she might be, you know, at book club or, she, you know, doing one of her things at a doctor's appointment, and I'd be like, Mum, what was a song that was played in, you know, and she'd just reel one off and then hang up. So she got quite good at firing off. But then she would speak to my dad and call back later and want to give me 5 songs. I'm like, I've moved on from that scene, Mum.
I've written that. It's done.
Too late.
Now, you have written a lot of books now, so you're going to have to be running out of character names. I always try very hard not to use names of people I know in my books, but I feel like you are leaning really far the other way. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's very common for me to, especially in a first draft, be writing and then, you know, a bit part comes on, someone, you know, not especially important, and I'll think, what name should I have? Oh, Jess. I'll pop it in. You know, it's so arbitrary at that point, and often they will change. But I did that in the first few books in The Secrets of Midwives. In fact, all of my best girlfriends, the ones I was speaking to about earlier, they all feature as little roles in that book. And that started a trend that people now come to me and ask if they can be in a book, and all my cousins have been in there, and you know, my cleaning lady, and you know,
nieces and nephews. Yeah.
Occasionally people have bid on the opportunity to have a name in a book for a charity. This year there was a really special one, and there was a book blogger by the name of Linda Ratey, and she was known in the book blogging community as Lily Ratey. And she was incredibly beloved in the Bookstagram community. And I had interacted with her a little bit. And then about a year ago, a little bit more, I met a bunch of her friends at an event, and they told me that she had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I said, what can I do? And I made a video and we signed some books for her. And then right before Christmas, one of her friends got in touch again and said she's dying, and would you have a FaceTime with her? And I said, of course I will. And I FaceTimed with her, and she was in the hospital, and she was talking about my books and how much she loved them. And I said, well, would you like to have your name in one of the books? And she said yes. So I was my honour to be able to name her in this book. And next,
and she's a good character.
Yeah,
she's
she a good is. Person oh no, that was book. She was only ever going to be a good character. And next week in Melbourne, her family are coming along to the launch, and are going to we'll have a moment for them. So that I think sometimes it's a funny thing. You know, I've also included some friends of mine, Sarah and Lee's, who
I noticed that they are a pair of amazing podcasters, mm-hmm. And you've made them police officers. And one of them is a detective inspector,
yep.
And one of them is just a detective.
That
and
I
wonder
that
if that's
going to
cause some trouble in paradise.
And they're very tall, as they are in real life. And one of them has got a very prominent forehead vein. And this is a true war that I have with Sarah, my friend, because we both have got prominent forehead veins. And we've both Googled it, and apparently it's a sign of wealth. So we're still waiting and buying a lot of Tats Lotto tickets, but we have got a little bit of a war that when we've got a particularly, you know, it's a hot day or something, we send photos of our forehead veins so to each other. And
it's
and
all the thinking. I'm pretty sure that's what causes it.
But what I love about it is that most people will just read it and think, that's a weird detail to put in, and then like and keep reading. But for some people it's a little Easter egg, which is nice. Yeah,
it's a lot of fun. Now, are we going to see Mabel on the big screen? Because we've just seen The Family Next Door, as we heard earlier, being a huge smash hit for the ABC. Any sign of...
I hope so. At this point, no. I've had a few books optioned and that are on the way, the Soulmate and Darling Girls, and my short story Uncharted Waters have all been optioned and are in production. I would love to see Mad Mabel on the big or small screen. I think she would be fantastic, played by Lily Tomlin.
Oh my goodness.
And maybe Jane Fonda could be Daphne. I know we're going American there.
That's perfection. I love that.
I think that would be wonderful. But, you know, I think the most important thing, having had the TV series as well, is that while I love that happening, it was really exciting to be, you know, an insider in how that's all made. For me, the great love is the book and writing the book and the narrative and the between the dialogue pieces that we get to do with books. So I guess that's the most important thing.
And you got to be an extra as well, didn't you?
I did. And they gave me a real coffee, which was special. And it was at the scene in The Family Next Door where I was an extra was at my local coffee shop, which was really cool. And my barista, who makes my coffee every day, she got to be in it as well. So she made real coffees, and then she was in it for 2 seconds. She put the coffee down and then walked out. And so she was so chuffed about that too.
So was everybody else in that scene drinking invisible, imaginary hot water or...?
No, we all got real
coffees.
You all
got real coffees?
And they were cold,
presumably, by the time.
No, because she was... So they said usually they have prop coffees and things, but they were delighted because my friend, my barista, was just kept topping up everyone's coffees. It was fantastic, just for the free coffee.
Oh, Nick Healy, you're on ABC Nightlife across the nation. We're having a quick listen to a literary lunch Q&A with best-selling author Sally Hepworth, having a chat with fellow author Jessica Detman about her book Mad Mabel. And right now, Jessica's asking Sally what the future holds for her writing.
The book is also about a search for love in lots of different ways and about the myriad forms that love can take and the unexpected places that we can find it. Apart from with strangers in a 2-star motel in Los Angeles.
How many of you know that story?
Does anyone not anyone? Know that?
Oh, okay.
Do you want to just tell that story?
Should I tell that one
Go
first?
Go on, tell that story.
Okay. This has sort of got some community in it. Okay, this is a good one. This is one of my greatest hits. So it was 2 years ago, I think, maybe three. I was off to America on my book tour and I was feeling pretty good about myself. I thought, look at you, Sally, off on a worldwide tour. I was going business class, so you've never seen a more excited person going business class. I had my pajamas on before the plane had even taken off.
And for pretty much the rest of the tour, as I recall.
Yeah, wore them the whole time, looking around at the other people who clearly did it a lot, just looking nonchalant. I'm like, oh, it's boring. And I got from Melbourne to LA, and then I was meant to turn around and fly directly to New York. But when I got to LA, we found out that the plane was cancelled. because the pilot was sick, which seemed odd to me that they didn't have a second pilot, but whatever, and it wasn't going to be leaving until the next morning. And I was thought, that's okay, we'll go to a, you know, Holiday Inn or something. Well, we were then informed that there were no hotels available because WrestleMania was on in LA. This is where I thought someone was videoing it and it just couldn't be real. But in fact, we were sort of stranded and my phone wasn't working because I'd just come from Australia and I was thinking, shit, what am I going to do? And there was another woman, an Australian woman there, and she was one of those people that, you know, she knew what she was doing. So I just went and stood near her, you know, because I thought
she'll look after me.
She knows what she's doing. And I heard her on the phone booking a hotel room. And I thought, great. So I kind of waved and said, can I do that too? And she said yes. And I took the phone, I booked the room with them. And then there was another man also travelling by himself and he did the same thing. 5 minutes later, the three of us jump into an Uber together, new friends, and we went to the hotel, which unfortunately I put in the wrong address to the Uber. So we went in the wrong direction. My fault. That was fine. We got the Uber back to the correct hotel, where we found that we had booked it for the following night and there were no rooms available that night because of WrestleMania. And they said, there is one room available just down the road. And without looking at it, I said, Lorraine, do you want to share? Just met Lorraine. And Lorraine was like, yep, you know, just didn't think about it. Mark, on the other hand, we didn't say that to him. We just sort of thought, okay. And so off we went. Down to the, as soon as we got onto the road, you could see it was one of those motels, you know, from the American TV shows where all the prostitutes get killed. You know, like there's the car, the parking lot, and then the stairs on the outside that go up to the second floor, the Arby's next door, and, you know, all the scary looking drunk people outside. But this is all we had. They had one room available with a queen size bed. Mark saw us off. He went to try his luck somewhere else. And Lorraine and I took it in turns, had our showers. We put on our Qantas pyjamas, both of us, hopped into bed side by side. And then, just when you think the story's over, we heard at the door. And I thought, oh, my God, it's the person who comes to kill the prostitutes. And I said, Lorraine, did you hear that? And Lorraine was a bit hard of hearing. And she said, hear what? And I said, and then there was another knock. I said, Lorraine.
And there's Lorraine, a murderer at the door.
Someone's at the door. And she said, who would be at the door? I'm like, oh. So we got up in our pajamas together and we walked over and we looked through the peephole. Like, when do you think you're ever going to look through the peephole? And standing outside is Mark. He couldn't find a hotel room. He came in. He slept on the floor.
In his Qantas pyjamas?
No, he didn't have Qantas pyjamas. And I remember he took off his jeans and he was wearing electric blue boxer shorts. And I thought, put it away, Mark.
So everyone was safe.
But I just, as I sort of nodded off to sleep, I thought to myself, when my body is found, how is my family going to make sense of this? Like, that they put me on a plane to New York and I ended up dead in a two-star motel with a middle-aged man and woman.
In a pair of electric blue boxer shorts.
Yeah.
I'm very glad you made it out. And I know that everyone will probably want to know what is coming next after Mad Mabel. You don't get a break, sorry. Just keep going. You've been writing a book a year for over a decade and they've all been bestsellers. Do you still love it? Are you going to do it again or are you done?
No, I'm hanging up my boots now. No, just kidding. My publisher just had a heart attack. No, I'm writing a book. I don't know. I was saying last night at dinner with the publishers that I think I'll always write books. I can't imagine a time where, like with another job, that you'll retire and just close the computer and say, I'm done with that. I think I'll always write stories. It might be in a different, I might be more leisurely about it one day. But I've also had some really fun opportunities in the last couple of years to do different things. Like I did have a chance to be in the writer's room for The Family Next Door, which is, you know, completely different. And as I said, I love books more, but I really love to exercise that muscle. I am going to be working on a podcast next year, which was going to be really interesting. So I think new things are coming, but for me, the first love is books. So yes, I've got another book I'm about halfway through. It's about divorce.
Imagine.
No guessing, no telling who dies. And it'll be the things, you know, as I said, I write about family dysfunctionality with a side of murder, or as I heard this week, heartwarming stories about murder. So
I love that. Well, I for one am delighted to hear that there will be another book and then another and another. I think we might throw open to some questions now. If anyone has anything they would like to ask Sally, please be brave. No question too stupid.
We've got a roving mic over here. There's one here. Oh.
Sally, hello.
Hello.
I adore your books. I love the way you can tap into the family, and it sounds like you have a great relationship with your own family, but you use that to create interesting situations, and it sounds like you really are aware of everything around you. So thank you very much for that. How do you find those tricky bits? Like, so you've got the love, you've got the family, but how do you go into that, the little tricks, the next thing in the novels, which is always a twist? I think amazing.
Thank you so much, first of all. So there's kind of two things there. I rely more and more on real life things that happen. Not necessarily just a retelling of that. Like, for example, there was for the mother-in-law, which is my book about mother-in-law who's murdered, sorry. I put in this story about a chicken that was this infamous story with my mother's group, because one of the women in the group had just had a baby, and she showed up to mother's group with a brand new baby and a chicken in the bag, like a chicken that you cook. A raw chicken. Not a bok chicken, you know, like it's poor chicken. And like a roast chicken.
But not yet roasted.
Not yet
a
roasted.
A raw chicken, a dead raw chicken.
A dead chicken. Yeah, got it. And not, yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
From the supermarket
or the chicken shop. And we said, why have you got a chicken? And she said, my mother-in-law just gave it to me. And she said, do you think this was a passive-aggressive move because she thinks I should cook more chicken? And we spent the entire mother's group talking about what she meant by that chicken.
I don't think there's anything passive about that move.
That's
an outright aggressive move.
But what was so good? So everyone agreed that it was an aggressive move and that she was a horrible person and that we didn't like her. At the end of the mother's group, Anna got a phone call from her mother-in-law saying, sorry, I think I left my chicken at your house that I picked up to take home to cook for dinner. And I just, God, we laughed about that. And I think that those things are such a beautiful, I'm always into the why. And I always think that people have got a good reason for doing what they do, you know, and it's usually a good reason, not always. But usually it is. And so I try to go into those little things like, you know, so there was a real chicken, that chicken story appeared in the mother-in-law. But she had more nefarious, you know, intentions with that chicken. The twists is something a little bit different. I didn't even really know that I was known for books with twists until someone said to me, are you nervous about not having another twist for one of your novels? I was like, well, now I am. Steve, you know. But no, I think that a couple of the twists have come to me while I was writing them. And usually just from I write a lot of drafts and I'm very critical. I'm probably the most critical on myself. And if I'm not entertained, then it needs another go. And usually I get to the end and a twist will reveal itself if it hasn't happened already. But it also, I have to make sure that it's not a twist for the sake of a twist, because it needs to be in line with what's the theme of the book. Is this about friendship? Then I'm not going to do something that sort of flies in the face of that. Or this is a book about community, you know, and you just sort of carry that around in your consciousness for a while, and something presents itself, which sounds really airy-fairy, and I don't mean it to. I'm very pragmatic generally, but I do think there's something a little bit magic about the writing process. Do you think so?
Absolutely, yeah.
We have time for one last question.
So I'm really interested in Goodreads. I always see the authors on there. Do you read the Goodreads reviews that you get? And if you get a bad review, do you respond?
Oh, this is my favourite. Oh, this is a good place to end.
Yeah.
No, I don't respond. And I think I'm a bit unusual in the sense that my favourite reviews are the one-star reviews because they're so funny. My very first one-star review was on my fridge for a while. It was for my second book, The Things We Keep, and I can recite it to you verbatim. It said, "Before I read this book, I wandered around on this earth wondering, what was I put here for? But after reading this book, I now know that I was put on this earth to tell other people not to read this book."
That's incredible.
And I said I gave someone purpose.
My favourite one-star review was of my first book, and it was three words, and it is now quoted back to me fairly constantly, mostly by my children. It just said, "Big fat nope."
I think so, we've all got good ones, and a lot of most of us have got good sense of humour about them. I think it's harder when you're a new author, of course. But as I've spoken about earlier, my family blessed me with two things. One was a solid belief that I'm nothing special, in the best way, you know, that everyone's special and you're no specialer than anyone else. And the other one was a great sense of humour and ability to laugh at yourself. So going into writing books, I never expected that everyone would like my books. I don't expect it now. And I know that the more books you write, the more readers you have, the more one-star reviews that you'll have. And so if anything, it's a delight to read the 5-star reviews, but they're not as funny. The worst is the 3-star reviews, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Because they're trying to be fair.
Or, you know, I also think possibly the worst are the reviews that appear online before anybody could have possibly read your book.
Yes, and you know they've accidentally written the review of a different book.
Yeah, or they're just, you know, a book has appeared on Goodreads and they've gone, "I'll give that a solid 2.
Yeah.
Never heard of her, never read it, can't access it, it's not out for a year. Just give that a 2.
We'll just pop a 2 there. And then sometimes they'll say, one star, "I really enjoyed this book, but the cover arrived torn."
Oh, that's right. That's a lovely, lovely moment.
It's part of it, you know, and I think it is a reader's space to go and rate their books and use Goodreads as it's meant to be used. I don't think it's for people to respond. I live in fear of my dad responding because
I don't. Do you know anybody who responds to their reviews?
Oh, not personally.
Yeah,
but it never goes well.
No, that you will be turned on.
Yeah,
people will come for you if you do.
Yeah, it's a bad idea, and I think people have got to be able to say that they don't like books. Not everyone's going to like every book. I don't like every book.
No, but I do think it's also helpful to remember that. Just like the people who go on TripAdvisor, it's rarely the people who've had the very best time. You know, if you're off enjoying your life, living your best life, you've read a great book, you're probably going to go off and read another book. You may not go online to talk about it.
Trash it.
And I think the same goes for, you know, hotels and books.
A literary lunch with New York Times bestselling author Sally Hepworth, chatting there with other author Jessica Detman. Sally's latest novel is called Mad Mabel.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.